The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
And from
Dartmouth-Hitchcock, offering care in 30 locations across northern New England and in your community, Dartmouth-Hitchcock is here. Dartmouth-Hitchcock.org.
That feeling, when you know something is about to happen, you don't know what, but it's going to be bad. You know that feeling? Tim Samba felt that kind of dread on a Tuesday last August. He and his family are immigrants from Indonesia, and none of them have permanent legal status.
For some reason that day, I was feeling uneasy about this whole check-in.
The check-in was with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. That's the government office charged with deporting people. Technically, for the past several years, ICE officers could have deported Tim and his family at any time. They just hadn't yet.
And I don't know what it was, you know. Usually I'm like, fine, you know. So I just texted my mom while I was at work. I'm like, Mom, Dad, how'd it go? I think she didn't want to make me worried at the time. So she's like, now we have to come back next month.
That was pretty much the norm. Tim's parents would go to their check-in, an ICE official would ask a couple of questions, then write down a date when they had to come back. Since Donald Trump became president, the check-ins have been scheduled more frequently.
And then my aunt texted me, and she goes, hey, you're coming over to the house, right? Because at the time I was also working on my car at their house, because they had a garage. So I'm like, yeah, why? She's like, well, can you come see me first? And that kind of confirmed this uneasy feeling for some reason. I was like, okay, something's going on. So I went there and she opened it up with, so you have faith, right? You believe in God, you believe in miracles. I'm like, I know where this is going.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Today, living in limbo. What happens when the government won't grant a person citizenship, but won't spend the resources to deport them either? Producer Ben Henry has been reporting on a community of immigrants in New Hampshire who've been caught in exactly this kind of situation for years. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Virginia.
So tell me about this family you met, the Sambas.
Sure. So there is a community of Indonesian immigrants living mostly in the Seacoast area, and about 70 of them have overstayed their visas, and a judge has ordered them to be deported. But, and here's the but that this whole story kind of hinges on, they are very low priority on the list of people that ICE actually wants to deport. August 1st was when that situation changed. About 24 people, including Tim's parents, went for a regular kind of bureaucratic check-in with ICE. They were told they had 2 months to get out of the country.
2 months? Did that come as a surprise, or had they been waiting, you know, for the other shoe to eventually drop?
It was a surprise. It was a complete surprise. Nobody really knew what was going on at that time. There was a lot of confusion. And you have to understand, a lot of these people have been here for 2 decades now. Originally, they came to this country because they were afraid of religious persecution for being Christian in their home country. Because of that, they've been allowed to live here with a sort of intermediate immigration status. They don't quite clear the bar for getting religious asylum, but they're also not an urgent priority for deportation. They're in a sort of immigration limbo, like they're in America's waiting room. And that was what I wanted to know more about. How did we get here? For Tim and his family, this all started in the late 90s and early 2000s. Indonesia was hit by two destabilizing forces. First, the Asian financial crisis in 97. The economy cratered. Shortly after that, the country's longtime president, a powerful authoritarian, resigned amid riots and civil unrest. Ethnic and religious tensions that had been smoldering now flared up. Tim remembers the first time he saw this up close.
I was in middle school. I was going home from my school, right? And this is something I will never forget because it's crazy. So to get out from that school, you know, we have to kind of walk a little bit to get out of that kind of complex or neighborhood. And we have to go through this alley and then we'll see this main road. So I was just walking and I see this ocean of people and they attacked our school because I went to a Christian school, exclusively Christian school. And we were attacked from all kinds of direction. Like there was no escape. But I was able to get into public transportation and I could escape, you know, and I turned back again to see what's going on. It was just ocean of people running towards my school. I know that my distant cousin, we went to the same school, and he got hit in the back of his head with like this big log, you know. He had to be brought to the hospital, and my friend got stabbed in the arm. It was crazy.
Religious intolerance in the country was on the rise, according to a U.S. State Department report from 2001, especially among Islamic extremists in the majority Muslim country. The Indonesian government, in crisis, was not equipped to protect minorities from extremism. Although the violence didn't reach everyone, there are more than 17,000 islands in Indonesia. Not all of them saw these problems. But the people I met in Dover who came to the U.S., some of them had watched their churches burn down or their villages ransacked. To learn more about this, I went to a cookout at a church in Madbury. They were celebrating Indonesian Independence Day. Cooking up fried plantains and fresh fish. I was bringing the mood down, asking people about why they left. Like Hans Rizakota, he was manning the barbecue.
Call it satay, chicken yeah. Like shish kebab, you know?
Yeah.
And then marinate and ketchup, sauces, and ginger, and peanuts.
He left Indonesia in 1999 after his town was attacked.
In the morning, this early in the morning, you can hear this screaming Allahu Akbar, you know, and then they started there. You call that Molotov bomb, you know, they have the bottle with fuel in it and then with that torch, you know, and then it's throwing it into the house. So the fire become, you know, spread all over, yeah. But all what you can do is you have to leave your house without nothing, you know. So I feel guilty because I cannot help other people, you know, that screaming for help. But we have to, you know, help ourselves.
Hans and his family waited out the attacks. They left the country as soon as they could. Tim and his family followed not long after, in 2003. They moved to New Hampshire, where a community of Indonesians was growing. When people like Tim and Hans come to the U.S., they apply for something called religious asylum. They're asking the U.S. government to harbor them from persecution in their home country. Many of the Indonesians who fled to New Hampshire, they did receive religious asylum, and they have legal immigration status now. But not everyone. The way the laws are written, you usually need a lot of documentation, like police records of church burnings or testimony from authorities back home, which can be hard to get from a government in crisis. And there's no formula for how much proof is enough proof. Some judges are just less willing to grant asylum than others. Around 100 Indonesian immigrants lost their asylum cases and were denied permanent legal status. Of those, some were deported, but most weren't. Not because they were hiding from officials, they were cooperating with ICE. But nobody ever came to their house with handcuffs to deport them. They were just here, settling in, getting jobs, having kids, starting churches. They were in the waiting room.
There's more people that are here illegally than we have resources to effectively deport them.
This is Aaron Corcoran.
I'm a former law professor, and right now I'm a consultant.
To understand why authorities would deny a person legal status and then drag their feet in deporting that person, you've got to understand the structure of our immigration system. First of all, ballpark estimate, around 11 million people live in the U.S. without legal status.
Either they came with status and that status expired, or they came without status.
Imagine for a second deporting New York City, like all of New York City, and then bits of New Jersey, too. Whatever your feelings are about the ethics of deportation, logistically, that just wouldn't work. That would be a lot of plane tickets to buy, and a lot of court hearings. Because if a person thinks that they have a good reason to stay in the U.S., they are entitled to a day in court. That's their right to due process.
Right now, they're scheduling hearings for about 2 years out, just to give you a sense of the backlog. And they've hired a bunch of new immigration judges. They say we have about the resources to effectively remove about 450 to 500,000 individuals a year. And that's about the numbers of people that come across the borders annually. So if you've already got in the system a backlog that's been existing for years, then you have to figure out how you're going to prioritize.
Prioritizing resources. The Clinton administration actually put this idea into writing with a memo that said to immigration officials, listen, spend your time deporting criminals and recent immigrants with no legal argument for staying in the country. When it comes to people who have lived here for years without doing anything wrong, you can look the other way. In fact, not only is it necessary to sometimes look the other way, the memo said, it's completely legal. It's called prosecutorial discretion, and every administration since Clinton's has implemented some version of it. By 2001, dozens of Indonesian families were on the favorable end of prosecutorial discretion, mainly because a lot of them had kids, and by the time they actually lost their asylum cases, they had already been here for years. They were trying to stay in the good graces of the immigration system. That's why Tim, one day, found himself voluntarily and nervously turning himself in.
They have a tent, you know, that they set up with their laptops, and there were like three people with their laptops out, and there's a big trailer in the back. But they set this up in front of the Stafford County Jail. So I was like, oh boy, like what's going to happen here?
One of New Hampshire's senators, Gene Shaheen, had caught wind of the Indonesian community's troubles and helped broker a deal with ICE. The actual documents describing the deal are not public, but here's how it worked. If people like Tim and his parents, who had been denied religious asylum, showed up here in this parking lot and gave ICE all of their information, where they lived, where they worked and went to school, ICE would work with them. Tim and the others agreed to regular check-ins, too, so ICE could keep tabs on them in case anything changed. The name of the program was Operation Indonesian Surrender. Almost everyone who surrendered was given temporary status, a one-year permit to live here that you have to renew every year. This was prosecutorial discretion in action.
Thankfully, it went well for us because we thought initially, okay, we do this, we surrender this, we abide by the law, then it's going to open up some pathway for us to, you know, like, okay, maybe get our case reopened, get our case granted, something.
What ended up happening is he and his parents just stayed in limbo. They checked back with ICE every couple months. They got their temporary status renewed every year. And they went on with their lives. Tim went to school and got a job. But he also knew his status wasn't stable. Prosecutorial discretion is not actual law. Those memos from the executive branch are just guidelines. And they're flimsy. Here's Aaron Corcoran again.
They're only binding as so much as that administration continues to use them, and they can always be amended or repealed or superseded by other memorandum.
An incoming president can repeal these rules in one sitting and replace them with whatever they want. Skip forward to 2017, new president and new rules.
During his first 2 weeks in office, President Trump signed a series of executive orders that laid out the policy groundwork for the department.
That's Thomas Homan, acting director of ICE, testifying before a House Budget Committee. One executive order in particular included a sentence that undermined the concept of prosecutorial discretion. The order says everyone who can be deported should be deported, quote, promptly. That sounds like it's ICE just doing its job, and it is. But the premise of prosecutorial discretion is that, actually, not everyone who can be removed should be removed. Homan clearly picked up on the president's hardline stance.
once an alien has pursued the extent of their due process rights and a federal judge issues a final order of removal, it is ICE's job to enforce that order. If a federal judge's decision is not enforced, then there's absolutely no integrity in this entire system.
And Homan got to work. Within 100 days, ICE had arrested 41,000 immigrants, almost a 40% increase compared to the same period the previous year. Nobody told him and his parents what this meant for them. Prosecutorial discretion is still a thing in Trump's government, but it seemed to be changing. Chief of Staff John Kelly, who at the time was Secretary of Homeland Security, wrote a memo, and it narrowed the scope of prosecutorial discretion to make it more case by case so it can no longer be used to protect an entire group of people, like, for example, New Hampshire's Christian Indonesians.
I don't think anyone ever expected, including a lot of people at ICE, the quickness with which that change happened.
This is Bill Hahn, a lawyer for several Indonesians living on the seacoast.
And actually, I talked to people between January and July, and we had been trying to find out what's going to happen with the new administration. And what I kept hearing was the phrase, lack of guidance. People were saying, ICE doesn't even know what's going to do. They can't tell you because they don't know. Even people within ICE would say to me, they were just telling people, come back. Come back in 3 months, come back in 6 months, come back, whatever. You know, we're not sure what we're going to do.
An ICE spokesperson declined to provide details about what kind of guidance they were or were not getting at that time. At the beginning of the year, Hahn filed applications for his clients to renew that temporary status that they have.
And then we waited, and then all the denials started coming through.
Freddie and Poppy, Tim's parents, were among those denied their temporary status. Suddenly, they were back to where they started, but they were still cooperating with ICE. On August 1st, they go to their regularly scheduled check-in, and this time, they are given a deadline. They have 2 months to leave the country. Tim's parents started packing. They bought plane tickets. They got ready to leave behind the country that they had lived in for nearly 15 years. Tim had to decide whether he would stay here or go with them. He's now a DACA recipient, so he could choose to stay here, at least as long as that program stays afloat.
I got my certifications here. I graduated high school here. I met a lot of friends here, a lot of families that supported me. A lot of opportunities for me that I feel like if I leave it all behind, then I'm leaving all my hard work behind, my flesh and blood, you know, all my dreams and my career. It was a hard decision, but you know what? Got to go on, got to keep fighting for it.
He showed me around the apartment he shares with his parents, strewn with moving boxes and piles of clothes.
This is the living room, right? And these are three boxes that my parents, you know, think that they should send out. And these are, look at this, like this is all the shoes.
Others who had been a part of Operation Indonesian Surrender went to their check-ins, and most of them were told the same thing, 60 days. A lot of the reasons why a person could previously receive some prosecutorial discretion no longer seemed to apply, having U.S.-born kids or a medical condition or just having lived here for many years. All those things no longer sheltered someone from deportation.
60 days. You know, I go to court all the time. Judges know and lawyers know 60 days goes by in a flash. It's never enough time to do something important, whether it's picking up your life and leaving or if it's filing legal documents.
60 days ran out. During all of this, something was going on behind the scenes, something that I didn't find out about until the very last second. I was at the ICE office in Manchester. Tim's parents, Freddie and Poppy, were checking in. This was their very last check-in. They were actually the first two people out of the New Hampshire Indonesian community scheduled to leave the country. This was a Monday. Their plane tickets were for Wednesday. They were asking ICE one last time to stay.
And what did they tell you?
untuk pulang.
A friend translated for them.
We have to leave on Wednesday, September 27.
Are you guys ready to leave?
Yeah, harus siap.
We have to, she said. I had gotten a phone call earlier that day and learned that there was one chance. A group of lawyers had been working with some of the immigrants facing deportation, including Poppy and Freddie. They had just filed a class action lawsuit representing everyone who was a part of Operation Indonesian Surrender. The lawsuit argues that 60 days is not only not enough time to pack, it's also not enough time to file a legal case to try to stay in the country, which makes it a violation of the right to due process. And part of that suit was an emergency request for every ongoing deportation to just stop until the lawsuit got figured out. The day before Freddie and Poppy were due to leave the country for good, there was a hearing.
I just kept praying, you know.
Tim took the day off work.
Because I felt that I needed the time to spend with my parents, because this could be the last time, you know, I'll be spending time with them in this country.
About midday, one of the lawyers texted him. The message said, tell your parents not to go to the airport tomorrow.
My mom was in the bathroom. My dad was sitting right next to me watching, you know, news. I read the text, and I tackled my dad. I jumped at him. I hugged him. I started bawling my eyes out. And my dad's like, what's going on? What's wrong? Like, what? And I just said, you're staying.
For now. The judge ruled that defendants covered in the lawsuit could not be deported until further notice from the court. But that doesn't mean they have legal status. They just get a little more time, 4 months, to go back to court and try and get asylum, the asylum they were denied in the first place. They say things are getting worse in Indonesia for Christians, but like before, it's not an open and shut case. I asked him how he deals with this, the uncertainty, not being able to plan his future. Faith is a big part of his life. He said when he needs the help, he reads Romans 8:28. He has it saved on his phone.
And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. You know, I believe that. No matter what, man, I love this country. I feel like this is my home.
Our thanks to producer Ben Henry for this story. We did check in with Ben at the time of this original broadcast, and he reported that hearings in the class action lawsuit are still ongoing. Nobody from Tim's family or New Hampshire's Indonesian community has yet been deported. We will keep you posted on this story as it unfolds. And stick around for another installment from our Only in New Hampshire series, which asks today, is wood smoke as bad for you as smoking? We'll find out after a short break when Word of Mouth continues. Summer lingered a little longer than usual this year, with a string of hot and humid days in September and October. Now that temperatures have dipped below freezing, folks are shaking out their jackets and lighting up their wood stoves. Which brings us to our Only in New Hampshire question this week. Listener Evan asked, why does no one know or care that wood smoke is as bad for you as diesel smoke or cigarette smoke? Sort of a loaded question there, so let's first suss out the facts. Is wood smoke just as bad as those other more notorious varieties? And joining us is NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown, host of Outside In. That's a podcast about the natural world and how we use it. Hello, Sam.
Hey, Virginia.
So you strike up the wood stove yet?
We have not. No, we have not had the need.
Well, quick answer first. Are wood stove smoke, diesel smoke, and cigarette smoke all equally bad for you.
In fact, wood smoke might be worse for you than cigarette smoke, but that's only if you were to smoke it like you were to smoke a cigarette. And the infamous study in which this is based basically did just that. It burnt a piece of wood, burnt some tobacco, and analyzed what was inside both, the fumes coming off of both of them. And in fact, the wood smoke seemed to be worse for you than the cigarette smoke. However, you don't smoke wood like you smoke a cigarette. You burn it and you get the smoke away from you as quickly as possible. And so the health impacts of wood stoves are much fuzzier than the health impacts of cigarette smoke.
Well, let's talk about the stuff that's in them. What in particular is detrimental to the body about these varieties of smoke?
Well, there's all sorts of crazy stuff in wood smoke. I mean, with cigarettes, I'm sure you remember all the doctors who would go on TV and talk about the 7,000 chemicals that are in cigarettes. There are also a ton of chemicals in a chunk of wood, you know. And when you burn it, you get all sorts of very standard pollutants that you hear about. Nitrogen oxide, sulfur oxide, so NOx and SOx you might have heard about, which are also in power plant emissions, dioxins, formaldehyde. But to really talk about what matters, the most damaging thing that's in wood smoke that you hear about is particulate matter. And we're just talking about little tiny pieces of stuff that when you breathe it in are so small that they get way down deep into your lungs, get lodged there, and then your body has to deal with them, which you know, it can do in small doses, but gets overwhelmed very easily.
What about nicotine? That is not in wood smoke.
No, indeed not. And in fact, there's a lot of stuff that's in cigarettes that's not in wood smoke. A lot of that sort of active ingredients, the carcinogens in cigarettes, are things that when you breathe in a cigarette become gasified and are actually absorbed into your lungs, like nicotine is. The particulates, that's not what happens. They just sort of get lodged there. But nicotine isn't really bad for you in the same way that many of the other contents of cigarettes are. Nicotine is more like caffeine. It's a slightly addictive substance that makes it so that you're coming back to cigarettes over and over, and therein lies the health risk. And wood smoke does have things that are absorbed into your lungs. It's just that those aren't really the large health risk when it comes to wood smoke. We're really talking about this big dose of tiny little chunks of stuff that you get in your lungs from breathing it in.
So if you were in a not very well ventilated room, for example.
Yeah. And in fact, this is one of the things that if you're worried about, this is the first time you're hearing about this and you're worried about these health impacts, what you can do is you can try to minimize the amount of time that you smell wood smoke in your house. You know, try to light your stove really efficiently so you don't get wood smoke in the house. Try to stoke the stove less frequently so you're not opening the door as much. If you smell that smoke, that's a good indication that you're doing something bad for your lungs.
How about wood pellet stoves? Those are supposed to be so much better environmentally.
Wood pellet stoves are much cleaner burning than wood stoves. And in fact, I brought a handy dandy little visual aid for you to react to here. This shows the amount of particulate matter that is put out by the various types of things you can burn. If you look on the far left of that graph, you see a traditional fireplace. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly dirty. And in fact, the y-axis of that graph had to be manipulated.
It goes 1, 2, 3, 4, and then jumps to 28.
Just so that they can show what fireplaces do. A new wood stove is 28 times less particulate matter than that, and a pellet stove is about half of what a new wood stove puts out.
And then oil furnace, gas furnace, way down on the bottom of that axis as far as output.
And the reason for that is that pellets they're a uniform fuel. You can control how the combustion happens, and it burns completely. And that's really what the particulates are, is they're uncombusted wood that are tiny, tiny pieces of it floating in the smoke and into your lungs.
Okay, so you said you don't smoke a wood stove, a burning piece of wood the same way that you take in a cigarette, like suck it in. But how about what's hanging in the atmosphere? You walk out of a house where people have been burning wood and you can actually smell wood smoke on them.
And in fact, if you're smelling wood smoke, you are getting some of that particulate matter into your lungs. And this is why organizations like the American Lung Association want to transition away from burning wood as a source of home heating. And it also gives you sort of an indication of if you want to heat with wood and want to be a little more responsible, some of the things that you can do. For instance, this time of year is a really bad time of year to burn wood because the air is warm, so the smoke comes out of the chimney. It's about the same density as the air that it hits and starts to sink back down. And you'll see this time of year where you go past a house that's burning wood and there's this sort of pall of smoke that's hanging around the house. Mm-hmm. When you get to winter, the air is colder, it's denser, and so the smoke rises up and away from the house and you're not breathing as much of it. So not burning wood in the shoulder seasons, the spring and the fall, is a good way to be a little more responsible. Also, as that graph shows you, new wood stoves are much cleaner burning than old wood stoves and way cleaner burning than fireplaces. So buying yourself a new wood stove is a way to be more responsible.
How about, you know, in industrial plants, they put scrubbers on the chimneys, right, to clean out the chemicals or to mitigate them as they're going into the atmosphere.
Yeah, well, and there's a funny thing that happens is every year there's a competition for who can build a cleaner burning wood stove that the U.S. Department of Energy puts on. And that's where catalytic converter wood stoves have come from, which you might have encountered one of those in your travels. They're the ones that you have to start them up and then you engage the catalytic converter with a lever that goes ka-chunk into place.
Haven't run into that yet. Haven't had to have that inspection done yet. But what about our listener, Evan, who phrased his question in a particular way? Why does no one care about this issue? Is there an awareness problem, Sam? Do you think he's right to phrase it that way?
Well, I think what he's responding to is that we have a culture of burning wood up here in the colder parts of the United States. Wood heat, for a lot of people, they consider it to be quote-unquote free mm-hmm. because if the wood's coming from your property, you're cutting it yourself, you're only paying for it with your time and labor. And so it's part of the sort of Yankee identity. And I would say that there is pushback to these campaigns to get people off of wood heat. So that's what I detect in the tenor of his question is why does no one care about these public health campaigns that have been going on for decades now?
Well, there is something psychological, though, about the look of wood burning in a stove. Isn't there, you know, this sense of the hearth, especially on a cold winter day?
There's nothing more pleasant than standing next to a warm wood stove when it's cold outside. And I will confess, I heat with wood at my home. But knowing about these issues, I try to do it at times when there are going to be fewer people outside and around. I try to do it at times when the smoke's not going to hang around, and I bought myself a new, cleaner burning wood stove.
Okay, do you shift it into gear?
It's not a catalytic converter stove. It's a reburner.
Sam Evans-Brown, host of Outside In, NHPR's podcast about the natural world and how we use it. Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can ask questions about your New Hampshire community. Click on the Only in New Hampshire page at nhpr.org, and we'll see if we can dig up an answer. Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Ben Henry, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Hannah McCarthy. Special thanks today to Sandra Pronto and Robbie Peters for their help on the story of Indonesian immigrants living in New Hampshire. Maureen McMurray is director of the Michael Jackson Popcorn GIF. Music in this episode from Ryan Little and Tyler Gibbons. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more of your questions answered and your state explored next week. But between now and then, you can come meet us. If you're a fan of NHPR Civics 101 podcast, and we think you should be, or a fan of trivia, we invite you to join us for our first ever Civics 101 Trivia Night. We'll be gathering on Wednesday, that's October 25th, at True Brew Barista in Concord. The theme, presidents. Real presidents, fictional presidents, and dead ones. Come show us what you've got and have a drink with us this Wednesday. You can find out more at wordofmouthradio.org.